Hello and welcome to another episode of Living with Dying, the podcast that I can't believe we started 2 years ago, almost exactly. And in the very early days, I brought my idea to Thames Hospice, where they were very supportive and encouraged me to go ahead with it because they felt like I did that we needed to talk a bit more about death and dying. So I'm thrilled that it's been going for 2 years and I've had a lot of help from the hospice since then. But today I'm excited to meet the new CEO, relatively new CEO, Rachel Decaux, who I haven't talked to before. So this is an opportunity, Rachel, for us to discuss what it's like for you working in the hospice sector, all the problems I know that you have around funding and so on.
Yeah.
But can we start by perhaps you telling me what drew you to the hospice movement in the first place?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's coming up to nearly a year since I joined.
Oh, is it? I beg
Time
your pardon.
Goes so quickly. and I still think it's a real honour and privilege to lead this organisation. The reason I came into the hospice sector, I still work clinically as a doctor.
Indeed.
It's still very, very important to me that patients receive high quality, safe care. And it was important to me to work in an organisation that aligned with my values. But more than that, I've had personal experience of hospice care. So many years ago now, both my parents unfortunately suffered with cancer. My mother was cared for in the community and my father was cared for in an inpatient hospice. And it really stuck with me, the personalised wraparound care that was not just for the patient, but the whole family. I think it's Dame Cicely Saunders that memorably said, the manner in which a patient dies lives in those that live on, stays with you. And that really stuck with me. And I felt that it was something that everyone should be entitled to receive.
So had you been aiming to work in the hospice sector, or was this something that just kind of came along?
It's one of those things, isn't it? You think you plan your life and career out. And then an old mentor said to me, sometimes you just have to seize opportunities when they come along and the timing is right and the fit is right. And it just so happened that the Thames Hospice Chief Exec role came along at just the right time. When I was ready for a new challenge, when the sector is going through a really interesting and exciting and at times challenging period in its history. And if you like, the stars aligned.
Do you work as a doctor here or do you work as a doctor elsewhere and combine that? How does that
so
work?
So I combine it. So I work as a consultant in emergency medicine. So I specialise in trauma and emergency medicine at the Royal Berkshire Hospital in Reading. And I've been a consultant there for nearly 14 years now. So I have always combined senior managerial roles with that on the ground, seeing patients, clinical work, because I think it's really important that you keep the patient at the heart of what you do, and it helps me to do that. But I spent about 8 years flying on the air ambulance
Oh, really?
As a doctor, so I have definitely a specialist interest in trauma.
Don't see much of that here, I suppose, do you?
No, this is at the other end of the spectrum, certainly, but no less complex or challenging.
Now, I see a lot of you on social media, out and about all the time, meeting different people. You seem to be networking with a whole range of people in the community, meeting other charities, doing a lot of things in order to fundraise. Is that a big part of the role?
It's a huge part of the role. So the chief exec role, I see as you have to balance equally the internal and the external. The internal and our people is really important because the chief exec helps set and shape the culture and tone of the organisation, and I really want that to be a sense of belonging and inclusion and that we develop our people. But equally, the external relationships with stakeholders are really important, whether that be major donors or companies or our supporters that are busy running marathons and jumping out of aeroplanes, or really if it's our community and letting them know who we are and what we do. I think hospices are something that you don't necessarily think of unless you or a member of your family have needed their services. And then you wonder how on earth you ever could do without them. And there are so many really worthy charities. And so, yes, I do see a big part of my role is to raise awareness, to network and to make sure that people know we're here for them. And we've had brilliant support from lots and lots of different corporates, big and small, often those that are embedded in the local community. But more than that, we always see it as a bit of a partnership. So many of their staff volunteer with us, which is a lovely way of giving back. Or they will be their chosen charity for the year and the staff will fundraise for us. So there's lots of different ways that an organisation can be involved with Thames Hospice, and we really do see it as we want to have a relationship with them for many years rather than a kind of transactional relationship. So no, they've been really, really welcoming, well received, and I'm delighted to have a few more on board.
And not that long ago, I interviewed Toby Porter, who's the CEO of Hospice UK, and he was able to explain to me the difficulties that hospices are going through at the moment with not enough funding from the government. But since then, some more funding came along, didn't it? Has that solved all your problems?
Oh, I wish it had. So we're always very delighted when the government gives any form of funding, especially given how challenging it is at the moment. But that funding was one-off. And it can only be used for capital, so it can be used for things like buildings. What it doesn't really help us with is the repeated pressure of running costs, so to pay for all our wonderful nurses and paramedics and doctors. And that 100 million was for nearly 200 hospices across the country and over 2 years. So by the time you get your little segment of it, whilst we're enormously grateful, it still leaves us with a big cost pressure year in, year out. And with the money that we receive from the NHS, we still have to raise £39,000 every single day to keep our services running.
Every day?
Every single day. So when people say, oh, does anything keep you awake at night? Not much, except that. Because I know how in demand our services are. And I know how valuable and valued our people are that work with us.
And some hospices have had to close down rooms, haven't they, and accept fewer people. Have you had to do anything?
So we haven't had to make any changes within the last year. But prior to my arrival, we did have to take the really difficult decision to close 8 of our 28 inpatient beds. That was partly for financial reasons, but partly because we change the way we deliver our community services. And people often think about hospice patients as sitting in beds nice and quietly. But actually every day we look after about 370 people in their own homes. And for a lot of people, that would be their place they choose to be looked after. So we changed the way our services were provided to meet what our population wants and needs. And that meant we didn't need those 8 beds right now. In 2 years' time, with the changes in our population, we absolutely will need them. And so we do have to try and find a way of making that funding sustainable.
Because we are all getting older.
We're getting older and people are more complex. So rather than having one or two diagnoses, so for example, just an end-of-life diagnosis, they may also have heart failure, lung failure, diabetes, kidney problems, dementia. And so the whole patient that you're looking after suddenly becomes a lot more complex. And I think the other thing people maybe don't realise is that close to 40% of our patients are not cancer. They are motor neurons disease or multiple sclerosis or heart failure. And so again, we're constantly having to readjust our services depending on what our patients need.
You have to be able to deliver all that care, no matter what it is, no matter what comes to you.
Indeed. And, you know, as many people have said before, we're seeing younger people with cancers in their 30s and 40s. And that, of course, brings different challenges. So they often have school-aged children. And so our counselling and bereavement and children's support teams really do need to wrap around that family. And we're seeing children from the children's hospice that previously may not have survived childhood, but with modern medical advances, they're coming under our care for a couple of years. And that also requires a different skill set. And, you know, adolescence, it's a pretty difficult time anyway. You add in some complex family dynamics and that transition from children's to adult hospice, and it can be pretty tough.
You explain it so well, but it sounds an enormous field of work that you cover.
It is. I've done other executive roles in the NHS for over 10 years. This is the most complex organisation I've ever worked in.
And am I right in thinking that you not only look after people at home, but you sometimes do ongoing care for some people who may not be dying soon, but still need help?
Absolutely. And we also have a big outpatient service where Often patients choose to come into an outpatient program where we can help control their symptoms, or we can give them access to counselling. But more than that, we work with solicitors and financial advisors so that patients can, for example, get advice on their wills or power of attorney or all of life's admin that can be really pretty difficult at times of stress. And I think the best thing of all is it allows patients to sit and chat with other patients. There's something very difficult about chatting with your peers. People are going through a very similar journey that I think is really valuable. So not just the kind of medical bit we do, I think it's the wider bit that's important.
So you have coffee mornings and things
so,
like
yeah,
that.
So yeah, and often our male patients, interestingly enough, they may not necessarily want to open up and chat in a one-on-one, but they might well do so when they're playing a game of cards or they're playing some dominoes or they're doing something creative. So it's just about kind of tapping into to what works for people.
And those could be inpatients or outpatients, could
they?
Yeah,
they could be.
Either.
They could be.
Gosh, you do so much. It's real wraparound care, isn't it?
It's wraparound care and also never forgetting the family that are caring. Mm. So we know there's more to do in that space, but, you know, having seen it firsthand, it's really hard work being the primary relative caregiver to someone that's suffering. And often people feeling they have to do it all themselves and want
and
to.
Wanting to, yes.
And want to, yeah.
But with a bit of help is easier, I suppose, isn't it?
Yeah.
Without. Did I read something about some hospital somewhere who used to pay hospices to give end-of-life care for their patients have now stopped that funding, which has left some hospices in the lurch? That didn't seem to make any sense at all to me, because isn't that exactly what we need, people to get out of hospital beds?
Yeah, I'm not close enough to the detail of that specific example. You're absolutely right, it was over in Cambridge. And it does seem to go against all direction of travel, which is we know that patients would rather be looked after either in their own homes or in a hospice than in a busy acute hospital ward. We know that financially it makes better sense to look after patients in that way. And we know that, for example, the government's 10-year plan is all about moving care closer to people's homes and into the community. So yes, it does seem to rather fly in the face of that. And given how precarious hospice finances are, you don't need much of a change to really have a pretty devastating effect on the service you're able to provide.
So are you suggesting that hospices are kind of on the edge?
I think it is more fragile than the sector's ever seen, without a doubt, in the face of rising demand. And we all know how busy our hospitals are. We all know how much pressure they're under. And what we need to make sure is that the right patients are in those hospital beds, and the patients that can be more appropriately cared for in a perhaps calmer surrounding are not in those beds. And we work really, really closely with our local acute hospitals, with our primary care GPs, care homes, the ambulance service, to try and make sure that that doesn't happen. So we're one of the few hospices that provides a 24-hour day, 7-day-a-week response service with teams going out into patients' homes, so that if there is an urgent need, we can go out and see someone at 2 o'clock in the morning and hopefully stop an ambulance being called and settle them in their own environment.
That is so wonderful and so needed, isn't it? And if I cast my mind back to when my husband was unwell, I had no idea that hospices did all this for people. And I can remember one day knowing that what he really needed more than anything was to have intravenous antibiotics at home, administered at home. And I phoned round a few places like care homes and so on to see if they would do it, and they all said no. I guess if I'd known that the hospices might be able to do it, I could have phoned here, but I didn't have any idea. And in the end, that's kind of what he needed and why he went into hospital. So how do we let people know the wonderful service that is there?
I mean, I think we don't necessarily help ourselves, talking more broadly than TENS Hospice. We have a health system that's so difficult to navigate for people, with so many different entry points. And, you know, it varies depending on where you live. So a service that might be provided in this area, if you went to Oxford, might have a completely different service. And that doesn't make things very easy. So what we have to try and do, and the reason why I'm out and about so much, is to certainly for our community and our GPs and hospitals, care homes and ambulance service, that we're really clear with them what we provide and they know how to access it. We can only try to sort of control the bits, if you like, that are within our patch. And I'm well aware that there's huge variety across the country as well, which doesn't help. But we do try and simplify things so we have one phone number, one single point of access, so that we don't confuse people even further.
And do all the local GP practices know of all the services that you offer?
So I think that's down to us, that we need to do further education. I think we have done some work in that area, but there's undoubtedly much more to do. And I, you know, I do have a real sympathy with local GPs. They are under immense pressure at the moment, balancing a huge number of patients. So it is for us to try and give them the information they need to make their lives a bit easier.
Now, you mentioned earlier on about losing your father and your mother both to cancer.
Yeah.
I wondered if your experience of grief that you felt for them enters into your work on an everyday basis here, or whether the other way around, really, maybe being here informs your attitude to grief.
Yeah, and I think also in my clinical work, I see grief in different ways. I see people who have very unexpected grief when something happens very suddenly in an emergency department. You know, someone goes off to work completely well and has a car accident. So I think I've witnessed both ends of that. I think what I remember most about my experience with my parents was kind of don't underestimate how very little acts of kindness really do stick with you. And I guess that's what I notice with our staff, whether it's our pastoral team or nurses on the inpatient unit, that personalised little act of kindness, whether it's, you know, the fact that at 5:30 every day we take an alcohol drinks trolley round to all of our patients with a volunteer, you know, a little bit of normality, a little bit of, yes, you can, if you wish, sit and have a drink in the evening with your relative. That sticks with you. I think what I did, which I'm not saying is the right thing to do, is I coped afterwards by keeping myself busy. I kept myself distracted. And that probably helped initially because it stopped that really raw, intense feeling of grief. But at some point you do have to pause and stop and process it and allow yourself the time to grieve, the time to remember, and then eventually that really raw pain gets less and you are able to remember, and you remember the happy memories and the really good times. But there are still triggers now. If I pass someone that's wearing the same aftershave as my father, that will trigger. So smells trigger. Music as well. I think that's the other thing that I find sort of can take me back.
And what about these little acts of kindness that you experienced? Do you recall any of those?
I think it's just, I knew that, particularly my dad in an inpatient hospital, I knew he was getting brilliant care, but it was the fact that when I came to visit, they looked after me as well. Mm. They knew that the time I was working, I was actually working night shifts at the John Radcliffe Hospital in Oxford. I was doing my intensive care training and I would go straight from a night shift to go and visit. And I was tired. Mm. And yet there was someone there that looked after me, that made me some toast, that just asked if I was okay. And that really touched me.
I usually ask everybody what they suggest that people say to the recently bereaved and what they shouldn't say. Do you have any tips along those lines?
I think there's always a temptation, isn't it, that you want to take people's pain away. And you can't do that. I think you have to listen. I think you have to also respect that everyone's very different in how they may choose to grieve or share grief. And I do remember someone, and I know it's true, but at the time it didn't help when people say, oh, time's a great healer. Mm-hmm. It is, but when you're in that moment, it doesn't feel like it is. So I think it's just just listen, just be there, recognise that sometimes people want people to be around them, sometimes they just want to be in their own thoughts. There's no kind of right or wrong about it. And you can't rush people through the different stages. Everyone will have their own journey.
I think that's one of the problems, isn't it, that we don't know how other people are reacting, and the tendency is to think they'll be reacting like we did or might have done.
I always think being curious about the person who they've lost. People often quite want to talk about them, you know, and I think that's quite important to sort of talk about them as they were as an individual and let people chat through, oh, he used to do this thing, or their memories. I think the other thing is acknowledging that we serve a really diverse population here, and people have very different views on end of life. They have very different cultural practices at end of life, and it's about understanding and respecting that as well. And we constantly have to challenge ourselves, be curious, educate ourselves, make sure that we're bringing in those that perhaps have a different skill mix or outlook to ourselves, because we should be providing that.
And what about all the news around assisted dying, which is very much in the public consciousness at the moment? How is that going to impact hospices, do you think?
I mean, so on the one hand, the assisted dying debate has been incredibly helpful in raising the profile of end-of-life care and hospice care and how it's funded. I think it's really important to distinguish that hospice care is not assisted dying, and they're two very different things. And sometimes things get used interchangeably, and that's not ideal. As a hospice, we formally take a neutral position on it. We are watching really closely as the legislation passes through the House of Lords. It's a very emotive subject. It's emotive to our patients, our supporters, and our staff. It will have a huge societal impact if the legislation is passed. And what we will need to get our heads around is that when, if it is legal, some patients that we are looking after may decide that they wish to choose that. And that's really quite challenging for how some of our specialist teams have been trained. But clearly we are there to support the whole patient. So we will watch it. We will make sure we are educated appropriately. We need to see the detail of how it is planning to be introduced. But for me, I just don't want it to detract from the fact that we don't have end-of-life care right at the moment. We haven't got it funded correctly. I would never want a patient to be in a position that they feel they had no other choice because their suffering wasn't relieved by getting great end-of-life care. And so I do worry that we do need to address that first. But it's, you know, it's a complex and emotive issue. The important thing is to talk about it.
Do you think hospices will be involved in decision-making? I mean, you wouldn't want just to end up knowing you had to provide it without being consulted, would you?
You would really hope that they would value the opinion of a sector that is expert in providing end-of-life care. But even within palliative care, there's a real split of opinion amongst, you know, the medical team, nursing teams across the country. And I think that's fine as long as there is respectful debate from both sides. You can absolutely challenge someone that has a different opinion to you, but just respect that their opinion is different as well. I think individual hospices, as it becomes clearer what the detail is, will take individual positions on this. What I'm really keen to do is, as we see the detail, to hold almost like town hall events where we hear from our public supporters, patients, staff, and really hear the richness of discussion about what that might mean for us as a sector. But I think it is important to keep, certainly at the moment, the two things very, very separate.
That sounds a wonderful idea, holding town halls. Mm. But respectful debate is not something we're very good at right now in this country,
no.
Is it?
And I feel very sad about that, actually, because as I said, you know, since the beginning of time, people have held different positions on things, but we seem to have lost the art of debating intelligently and arriving at the end of the day with the fact we still may have different opinions, and that's okay.
That's okay, exactly. Yes. Yeah. But I wish you best of luck in trying to get it organised so that everybody gets the best care they possibly can in a hospice like this, which is so wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Rachel.
No.
Death is never easy, but there are ways we can help each other through it. And if you've found any of these episodes helpful, please think about liking and sharing. And if you can help spread the word by telling just one other person, thank you. And a huge thanks to Joe Barrett, without whom these podcasts would simply not be possible. You can contact us on hello@livingwithdying.co.uk.